Kathy Guo is an investor, author, and founder. After graduating from Columbia, an interesting turn of events brought her to the forefront of the blockchain revolution in India, where she started a company called Dunya Labs. After her work at Dunya Labs, she helped set up TrueBeacon with the founders of Zerodha, and since then she has worked extensively in early-stage venture investing in India with Antler, the world's fastest-growing VC firm. We discuss how Indian entrepreneurship has reached an inflection point with exceptional founders coming not just from metros like Bangalore and Delhi, but also from cities like Pune and Jaipur. We also talk about what qualities VCs look for in a business and why meditation can be helpful for a founder. Listen in. Thanks so much for joining us, Kathy. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Thanks so much for having me, Shreyans and Aman.
Awesome. So, Kathy, a really interesting thing about your background is that you weren't born in India. You actually had a bunch of different stages in your life that brought you to India. So it'd be really cool if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Totally. I think that so just for a little bit of background for your listeners, I'm Kathy. I was born in China actually, but emigrated to the US and Canada when I was relatively young, like 7, 8 years old. And I grew up there, went to Columbia. Right after I graduated, I basically started my India journey. And it's very strange. I think that it wasn't necessarily a first principles decision at first. It was, in fact, a very serendipitous and random decision where I happened to be, wanting to do something a little unconventional and a passion project after school, which led me to take up a book writing project with a fellow entrepreneur who was actually an Indian entrepreneur. And that was kind of my first exposure to India. Traveled around the country, did research, co-authored this book, which is about social entrepreneurship. It's called Myth of the Entrepreneur. And that really gave me a great, insight overview of India spanning multiple generations, multiple geographies. And I think that I really fell in love with the country slowly, got used to a lot of the ecosystem, learned about the culture, and really felt like it was a place where so many exciting developments were happening, first of all, but second of all, there was a real, potential to make an impact. So that's what has made me stay for the past, it's now been, oh my goodness, 4 years.
Wow. Okay. So before learning more about the whole India experience that you've had, what was the book about and how did that get you in contact with the Indian entrepreneur?
On the whole point regarding the book, so the book is called Myth of the Entrepreneur. It was essentially co-authored between me and Ravi Kailas, who is my co-author. He has been a serial entrepreneur in India since the 90s and has built businesses, in really cutting-edge domains. But more so than that, and having created, now his most recent company, Mitra Energy, has like multi-billion dollar enterprise value, was created from scratch, like a startup, is almost 80% held still by the founders, incredible conviction, incredible stamina and grit in building in new industries in a complex market like India. So I learned a lot, first of all, in that experience about what it actually means to be an entrepreneur. What is the kind of mindset? What is the kind of longevity? What does vision actually look like? And I think that Ravi gave me a ringside view of what the internal mind of an entrepreneur is, which as kind of a middle class professional first generation immigrant family I never had before. So that was an amazing exposure. I think the second thing was really, the book really opened my eyes to what does it mean, not just entrepreneurship in terms of creating, value as a commercial enterprise, but also what does it mean in terms of how the entrepreneur relates to society. So the whole book's thesis was about, can we rethink or at least go through this thought exercise of what it means to define the entrepreneur's relationship to greater society? This is a conversation we're having a lot now. If you even see in America, the conversation around institutional investors, people caring about ESG, I mean, that's just one tiny
Right.
component. But even the entire, multi-stakeholder view of capitalism is something that I think we're starting to have a conversation about all over the world. And I think, through the book, we also learn about and talk about the whole Tata lineage, the kind of Gandhian trusteeship that has run through Indian, society and some industrialists. And it's a very interesting model for social entrepreneurship, right? Believing that the entrepreneur is essentially a steward of resources, not an owner of resources. And ultimately, you know, your job is to not only create that value, but to direct that value into the places that have the highest impact for all levels of society and for all your stakeholders. I think that's a really interesting way, you know, to look at what it means to be an entrepreneur in the modern age.
Wow, that's super interesting. I never thought of it that way. Just the idea that Indian entrepreneurs are supposed to guide resources rather than own those resources. Do you think that contrasts with the, you know, how traditionally entrepreneurship is done maybe in America or in other countries in the West?
I think there was always a lineage, like, you know, patronage was still a big thing. Even if you look back to Carnegie, right, some of the earliest industrialists in the US, even there was this history of giving back. I think what's interesting about, you know, the Gandhian trusteeship model, and it's Gandhian in the sense that literally this was something that has been, that the Tatas essentially took from Gandhian thought, is, you know, Gandhi believed that this was a way to reconcile the competitive innovation building within capitalism with the kind of, you know, unequal distribution of resources and outputs. And I think that the reason why, you know, I think it's very interesting, the stewardship model, is it's not about creating wealth and then redistributing it as a person, right? Which is what a lot of American industrialists have done. You have Carnegie's name, Rockefeller's name everywhere, right? It was a way to retrace your lineage. The whole idea is, you know, these are things you never owned to begin with. And one thing that I thought was so motivating about something like Mitra is that the trust structure, whereby, you know, a lot of the founder ownership is held in a charitable trust, was not set up, you know, once the company had reached $1 billion or once they knew it was going to be a success. It literally started out in day one when there was no assets, no people, nothing, as a first principle of how you should build a company and what that company's purpose was. So I thought that was amazing, right? And clearly, you know, Ravi isn't 25, or, you know, this isn't his first day in the rodeo. And this is a kind of decision that the co-author took after many years of meditating on this exact question. But at the end of the day, you know, to do it from the beginning, to do it from scratch is pretty amazing.
That's super interesting. Wow, that's insightful. I think one thing that came to mind as soon as you sort of start talking about the social responsibility of entrepreneurs and the relationship, I think these conversations have also propped up with Coinbase and some other companies that have sort of, you know, adopted a more, we're mission focused, and we don't really you know, want employees to be talking shop.
Totally, Basecamp, right? As right. The most latest brouhaha in the Western tech ecosystem. And look, I mean, people are entitled to have their own views. We do live in a society where, you know, we allow for that. And at least in some of the democratic parts of the world, we allow for that difference of opinion. But I personally feel like, you know, if you're a corporation, you benefit from so many things within the construct, right? Simple example, like legal structure, right? The corporation itself in America is defined as being endowed with personhood, which means that it has certain rights, it has certain ability to execute contracts, it has certain rights that can be protected, a certain relationship to its assets, right? If you're in America, you benefit from the amazing public resources that are being spent in R&D that create talent, the immigration system, right? Like everything. And so I think it's really hard for me to, you know, agree with a philosophy that's like, we're completely detached from our ecosystem. We only focus on our mission, because literally every company's success is dependent on, sometimes in places like America, to a great extent, not obviously entirely, you know, the entrepreneur has put in incredibly hard work in all of these cases, and not to discount that at all. But to say that you're disconnected from a system is just untrue, because we, by definition, all live within a system. That system creates the conditions for our success or for our failure to some degree. And to say that, you know, we're not going to engage with it just seems to me to be a little disingenuous.
Definitely. That is definitely a perspective I hold to personally. I want to double click on your journey across India. So what are, you know, what were your main takeaways, a couple of takeaways that you had, that you learned while you were sort of traveling around India? Were they related to your book? Were there any other takeaways you sort of found that sort of made you want to stay here, that were interesting and you want to maybe share?
Yeah, totally. I mean, in Bangalore, I think the tech ecosystem, one takeaway is that it's really at an inflection point. I think the ecosystem now is at a stage where you really have a fantastic alumni of talent that are coming out of product organizations that have built world-class product technology products, right, for the globe. If you look at, you know, the Flipkart alumni, if you look at the Gojek alumni, if you look at so many of the folks that are building out of India, you just have a critical mass now of people who have seen that 0 to 100 journey, and you also have capital in the ecosystem. So I think those two things create a really, really interesting opportunity for massive value creation. Second observation is I think the world is getting more flat, right? This is true. Like if I'm interacting in a tech ecosystem in Bangalore, sure, there obviously are differences. Like it's there are differences living anywhere you choose in the world. But I think that in terms of, you know, if you interact with the best, the kinds of product philosophy, the kinds of tactics, the kinds of exposure are very similar. And, you know, that's also why at Antler, in my current role, you know, we have a lot of focus on looking at Indian entrepreneurs, founders, and talent who are tackling global problems from first principles. And I think that global ambition is really starting, right? Why can't you build the next American neobank out of India? We literally have a company in our portfolio right now that is doing exactly that. And something of that nature, right? Like if you think about neobank, regulatory, you know, customer persona, it's a consumer fintech. There's so many barriers for that being, you know, difficult as a, let's say, remote opportunity. But these founders are tackling it head on. They're so ambitious. They think they can win. And I love that kind of energy. So that's second. Thirdly, which is a little bit more personal, I think, is that I really love the community nature of the underlying society. I think that in India, it's a community-centric model for engaging, you know, with the world and engaging with your social circle, whether it's the joint family system or whether it's, you know, there are always trade-offs, right, to these things. I'm not saying that every expression of it is positive, but I think that, you know, the kind of camaraderie and the intimacy you can build with people that, you know, let you into their community is also amazing and something that I missed as an Asian, you know, living in the West. And I think lastly, which is also a little bit more personal, is, you know, I'm a big fan of ancient, I guess, more Indian practices like yoga, like meditation. They had a massive positive impact in my life. I think that there's something behind the efficacy of why they generally make us more happy, productive human beings. And the fact that, you know, in ancient Indian society, people were able to actually figure some of this out and develop these practices to such a deep level, you know, speaks something about the maturity and the focus of the society, which, you know, is pretty cool.
So the fact that you have this list of things that you think makes India such a great ecosystem for entrepreneurs, and your work with Antler is really closely tied into that. So could you tell us a little bit more about what Antler is and what the work you're doing, how does it make you special?
Totally. Great question, Aman. So at Antler, you know, I think what really drew me into being a part of the Antler team is that it's like one of the fastest growing VCs in the world. If you look at, you know, the trajectory of Antler across geographies, across stages, you know, our entire team has this move really fast and go really quickly. And underlying principle would be, you know, back exceptional people, which I think is an amazing mission to have in your work life and especially in tech. Secondly, I think Antler India in particular, I personally feel like, you know, it's one of the best places for a founder to become a VC. We have an all-founder team. Everyone has been in an operating position at some point or the other. Everyone is interested in not just deploying capital, but also co-building with entrepreneurs. That's why we go and participate. And, you know, we invest at the earliest stage. We want to be your first check, your first partner. We want to be someone by your side when founders literally just have a scrappy MVP out. They have their first 1,000 users. They don't even know what metrics mean something, what don't yet, you know. But figuring it out through that really messy 0 to 1 is something that gives our entire team the real kick. And I think that that's why, you know, myself and with my background and the kind of entrepreneurial exposure I've both had a privilege to have as well as want to have way more of in the future, I thought Antler India was a great place for me. So what we do in India currently is that we have two models. The first model is, you know, just saying it out there, I think we can be a better YC for India. I think that we can bring more localized interventions at the earliest stage. We can really co-build. We have the right expertise. We have the right team around us. So our ambition is, you know, we should be the first place that the earliest stage founders go to look for a partner who is going to back them with first principles. I think the second thing is, you know, how we do that is also we run a cohort-based program. We've brought on board some of the most awesome operators from the ecosystem, whether it's that's, you know, whether that's a Flipkart, whether that's a Paytm, whether that's a new age startup. You know, we have so many interesting people involved, and I think we really want to deliver that 10x cohort-based experience. The power of cohorts, really, I think, is, you know, that shared accountability and that shared learning, and also that deep community bond is an amazing thing to witness. We've just done our first program, and it was one of the most fun and rewarding experiences I've ever had. And we got a 90% NPS from our founders as well. I think part of the reason for that is the power of the community. And another part of the reason for that is that, you know, as founders, we've all been through that journey at the Antler India team. We all know just the trials and the craziness and the uncertainty and the loneliness of 0 to 1. And so we designed that whole experience with you know, having gone through that and being aware of what matters in that paradigm to our founders in that stage. So we do that program. We write a 175K check. And the second thing that we do is we also do standalone seed investments in some cases with a larger check, like 300K plus. So that's something we're also just speaking to founders, looking at teams, looking at investment opportunities. In the future, there might be some other exciting opportunities, right? But I think everything is basically subsumed under, you know, we want to be in India, you know, a founder's global pre-seed partner. We want to be global, right? We're a global platform. We have a global focus. We really want to also engage with founders that are building out of India for the globe. Secondly, pre-seed, right? Like, we literally write the first check. We write at the earliest stage. And thirdly, partner, which is all about, you know, the co-building and how we get our hands dirty.
That's amazing. I want to, you know, go back a little bit about what you said, that Antler is really trying to be better than YC in India. Why do you think, you know, with all the remote batches that YC's had, the record number of Indian startups that they started taking in those batches as well, what are the things that YC is missing so far with their program that maybe does not cater to Indian startups or the Indian ecosystem that I think, or that you think Antler can maybe one up?
Totally. I mean, the caveat here is just, I have immense respect for YC. You know, I love also their entrepreneur team. I love the dogged focus with which they've put a stake in their ground for what they represent, right? YC didn't go around saying, oh, I'm now going to do, you know, Series A investment. They obviously do pro rata in their portfolio companies, but outside that, they've been so disciplined. They also come with such an amazing team and ethos. So all the respect to them. And in many ways, they've paved the way for so many folks working at the earliest stage to know what matters and what has worked, right? So all the respect to them. I think that, you know, really why I say that, you know, we can do better is that the world, there's always iterations, there's always people who offer different things. And at Antler, you know, I think the main thing is just that localized context, right? Having a team which is all primarily executed, built in India, for India, or out of India for the globe, right? At the earliest stage, I think so many things are tactical. You know, it's great to get feedback on strategy, product, but so many times I pick up the phone, a founder, you know, he really needs to make one of his first senior hires. He can't even surface the first, you know, five top candidates, right? And if you're able to deliver three out of that five, you're really making that founder's life that much easier, you know, or calling up and saying, you know, this thing in legal or this thing in compliance, right? And you're able to get the right service provider to them, you know, emailed back in 3 minutes or whatever that might be, right? So I think that kind of localization and that focus at an early stage and with a smaller batch is just a different experience. So I think that's what we're trying to offer to our founders.
Cool. So on the topic of Antler investing in founders who are building for India, but also for the world, what kind of mental models do you use at Antler while you're deciding what kind of companies to fund? You've talked about the ambition being a big part of why you individually also are interested in India, but as an organization, what else are you looking at?
Actually, and alongside that, I noticed you mentioned we back exceptional people, and I wonder if, you know, do you also back exceptional ideas? Is that, so between those two, which one do you prefer? That might be something that our listeners would be interested in.
Yeah, in as well. That's a great question. Honestly, one of the things is I think we all love exceptional ideas, right? But I think at the early stage, one thing I've definitely learned is that the exceptional person behind that idea matters so much more, because at a 0 to 1 stage, the idea is constantly evolving. You know, the first iteration sometimes that an exceptional founder brings you, you might be like, okay, this person is great, but I don't know about this idea or this plan. But an exceptional person will listen to their users. An exceptional founder will, you know, be able to learn quickly and make the necessary strategic decisions quickly enough to get to something that works, right? And I think that, so, you know, versus like a great idea, but maybe a founder who can't execute or bring that to life or grow it in a certain way or make the right strategic calls, right? So I think for sure founder matters a lot more. Idea obviously matters a lot, but I'm just saying if you force me to stack rank, you know, I would always put the founder first. Secondly, in terms of what mental models for global, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of parameters for this. One thing that we obviously look for is that ambition piece, right? Because going global is something nice to see, right? But it entails a lot of difficulty, right? You're looking at a market that maybe you've never spent time in, or at least definitely not spent as much time in, right? You're looking at customer personas or enterprise personas who may not be closely defined or accessible to you, networks that may have not been built or slash are not complete. You're looking at founders who will likely at some point need to reroute their lives and uproot their lives and probably literally move to that target market, right, in order to be closer to those insights. So, you know, the ambition in the sense that, yeah, they have to have a really compelling passion and desire to go the full hog for what that, you know, maybe higher revenue or higher value creation entails. The second thing I think is really important always is a unique insight. It's so much harder far away to have that. And obviously some of that still needs to get shaped, but some beginning germinations of a problem insight, not a solution insight. I think founders often over-index on solutions because they tend to be in love with them. But in fact, understanding what your user and what your customer, what your ICP pain point is, and being as specific as possible or having a path to specificity on that and an insight on that is super important. And the third thing is obviously, you know, that there needs to be good structural market reasons for why the timing is right. That's super important at early stage, I think, because the gestation period for us is super long, right? 7 years sometimes, 10 years sometimes for companies to get to whether it's an exit or a massive scale. And what's important for that is that we need to be, you know, we need to be a little early on the idea side, right? If something, if there are companies right now in a particular market that already have 2-3 years, you know, earlier head start, then it's going to be very, very hard to catch up or et cetera. Then again, that there are exceptions to all these, right? There are also extremely mature markets where there's always further disruption iteration that can be possible. But I think, yeah, so those are the three that I would look at, just really the founder ambition and the founder reasons for wanting to go global. Secondly, the founder insight. And thirdly, you know, studying the market structurally for whatever problem they're attempting to solve to see, you know, what makes it such that something massive can be created to address this problem today. And is this the right time? Is this, you know, is this a little early? Is this a little late? Or is this, you know, somewhere within a sweet spot? These things are important. And that structural market question spans multiple different trends, right? That could be regulatory, that could be consumer behavior, that could be just something crazy macro like COVID, which has upended every single timeline of every structural market map that we had in our brains, let's say 18 months ago. So all this kind of stuff, yeah, goes into that.
Cool. So Queen, I really want to talk more about your exceptional people idea. If you could talk a little bit more about that, what do you exactly mean by exceptional people? Because especially as someone who was brought up in India, we oversubscribe to this fact that, oh, you should run after your IT degrees, study science. That's what makes you like good in a traditional sense. So
yeah.
At Antler, when you look at founders, what do you mean when you say exceptional people? Is it the traditional route or is it something else?
Yeah, good question. One thing that I love that's happening in India is I think that, you know, the stats are still not great, right? If you look at gender, if you look at IT, IEM, if you look at pedigree, I think recently I was even reading a report that's like even to this day, 34% or something of startups that got to a certain valuation in India are founded by, you know, foreign educated founders. Like, you know, these things are still there, but I definitely think it's changing very quickly, you know. And if you look at some like an ecosystem like Jaipur, you know, I've been talking to some SaaS folks, and the kinds of SaaS products and different tech products, different kinds of Salesforce plugins, like different crazy stuff that's being built out of Jaipur is pretty amazing. You know, there's an ed tech startup there as well that's growing really quickly. Like there's, so I think that slowly this pedigree monopoly will kind of go away. This has to do with probably just the ecosystem maturing. Also, probably also access to the tools to becoming an entrepreneur are becoming more democratized. Great kudos to things like YC Startup School, but also just the interweb, Twitter, you know, and building in public, right? So all these trends are coalescing into, I think talent can start to broaden a bit. It still hasn't happened yet in the numbers. It's not reflecting entirely. It'll take a couple more years, I think, but I definitely see it starting to happen. So Jaipur, Ahmedabad, obviously Pune has been there for a while, different places where we're seeing founders, young founders, 18-year-old founders, 15-year-old founders. So I think that exceptional people increasingly can come from anywhere. Second thing is, what does the mental model for exceptional people mean? Of course, there are some, you know, general rules of thumb we look for, right? It sounds like, it's hard because they sound like cliches and they're actually incredibly hard to test. Like, for instance, ambition is one of the most important things, right? Everyone knows that, like, in VC, it's go big or go home. You need the founder who wants to, like, go really big, right? And I tell founders all the time, look, it doesn't mean you're not exceptional, actually. It just means that you want to build a business with a different pace and ethos than a VC-backed business, right? I worked with the Zerota team, for instance, and those guys are exceptional. Nitin Kamath, Nikhil Kamath, Kailash Nod, they are some of the most exceptional human beings I've met in my life, hands down, whether it's in terms of intellect, contrarianism, being able to build a solid cultural tech, everything organization. But you know, they are not a fit for VC because they have this ethos internally, which is so strong to them, where they want control over their growth. They're in a business which is very cyclical and which they feel like sustainability is way more important than chasing after growth. They really value the kind of freedom that being bootstrapped has. They don't have to listen to any random board member, right? They don't have to worry about things being out of their control, shares being held by outsiders, right? So I think exceptional with a caveat, exceptional in VC terms means somebody who, you know, I think really wants to go big or go home and wants to go big really, really quickly. And capital is literally the leverage to do that, right? The reason for someone to take VC money would be to get access to that leverage and go on that trajectory. So testing whether or not an entrepreneur personally, because the other thing is we've totally fetishized VC, right? We've taken VC and we've been like, okay, that's your success. You get Sequoia funding, you get this, you have VC, yay. And I think that like, no, you know, founders need to really go through that self-interrogation where it's like, do you want to go on that trajectory? Are you ready for it? Are you dying for it? And there are founders who are like that. You know, they know that they've hit on an idea where it makes so much more sense to use capital to leverage the opportunity and win immediately. And, you know, you can see it in the way that they speak, the way that they do their projections, the way that, you know, they plan internally, the values they hold, whatever else, right? So that's one. Being exceptional also means other things as well, right? It means having really deep insight or having a really deep domain understanding. It means it's like passion, it means grit, perseverance, all those things you read about, you know, on the internet that people post on Twitter all the time. So yeah, but I think the actual hard part is spending time with a founder, figuring that out as a VC, interacting with a founder, and you know, and sometimes founders haven't even figured it out for themselves. So yeah. I'm sorry, very rambly answer to that one.
No, I think that was very insightful. I think you mentioned, I think a lot of these resources are also available today. If you, you know, you go on Twitter, you see all these threads. A lot of people value execution. That's something that I've heard VCs look for as well in exceptional founders, their ability to execute ruthlessly and just go big, like you said.
Totally. And I think one of the things we ask all the time at the firm is, you know, two things. Like one is like, is this a founder who's going to walk through doors? Like, will they literally be so determined that they're going to defy physics, I mean, not actually, but you know what I mean, to reach a certain aim. And sometimes a founder has that, you know, they are just going to, like, they're going to, a customer says no, they're going to show up at their door. They're going to, you know, I don't know, buy their dog a gift. I don't care. They're just going to be everywhere to make that deal happen. And the second thing we ask ourselves all the time is, you know, what will the world look like if that founder succeeds? And the best founders can paint that so vividly for you. And the impact is just so great. And I think that storytelling and that vision setting in early stage is really important, because yes, you obviously need to execute. You need a unique insight. You need to be able to, you know, actually go through with your plans and stuff like that. But in the beginning, you know, nobody has resources, right? So a founder needs to be someone who is able to create something out of nothing, to sell something out of nothing, to get employees with no money, to, you know, whatever. So I think that kind of storytelling actually goes a long way at an early stage.
Yeah, storytelling is this thing that everyone tells you is a really useful skill to have. But I don't know, formally, I have never seen a resource for how to learn it, except literally just talking to people more. And I guess this podcast is also a way for Shreyans and I to kind of practice those skills a little bit and learn from guests like you.
Totally.
Yeah. As for the fact that you should, you know, break through doors, again, it's the thing that it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission, and especially when it comes to building your business from scratch. So for our listeners, totally. Yeah, it's useful.
Agreed. And, you know, the best founders sometimes defy all labels. It's one of those things where it's like, you know it when you see it, and you know when you don't see it, but when you see it, it's like there are literally so many different mental models of successful founders: introverts, extroverts, you know, execution obsessed, vision strategy obsessed, you know, whatever. That it's really hard to, yeah, it's really hard to put like a definition on it. And I think that's what I also don't like so much about so much of the content that's created in the startup world these days, right? Because once you create a model, you create mimics, right? And you create kind of this internal game where like everyone's trying to mold themselves into, like, you know, and it's like coding, right? There's so many fewer, it's so much easier to get to pass a coding interview than to actually be a good coder. You know, it's so much easier now maybe to, like, even, you know, crack, or not reverse engineer, but definitely over prepare and crack a YC interview than like be a fantastic entrepreneur. Like, for every model you put out there, there's people trying to like reverse engineer it. And I'm just like, this is something you can't reverse engineer, guys. Like, it's just not. And in fact, I don't even think everyone should have that aspiration. I mean, we talk about all the time the glory and whatever else, but we're in a business where 99% of the outcomes is failure, right? Or 95% or something crazy. So I think if we were a little bit more honest about what entrepreneurship is and what VC is, then we would also just you know, save a lot of people's time who think that they want something like this. And a lot of people actually don't. So.
Totally. I want to transition to, you know, your work at Antler, and from your work at Antler to sort of what's going on in the entrepreneurship ecosystem a little bit more. So what kind of spaces are you seeing today that are emerging in the ecosystem? Are there any exciting spaces you're looking out for? Of course, there's always software as a service, for example, or consumer fintech, which you've heard about a lot. Are there any niche spaces that are coming up? Do you think there's some value in crypto, maybe some in longevity, those kind of areas?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, me and Nitin on the team, we're a little like crypto heads, but I don't know. I think that crypto is definitely very interesting, because, you know, in 2018, when I was starting up in crypto, I actually wasn't entirely certain where things were going. But what's amazing about this cycle is that, you know, beyond Bitcoin, beyond assets, you know, DeFi has really been such a game changer, you know, proving that there can be mass participants, like just looking at the volumes that Uniswap does, you know, just looking at the volumes that even someone more traditional or centralized like BlockFi does. It's
so
incredible.
Gavin, just to cut you off a little bit there, could you just explain what DeFi is for listeners who may not know?
Yeah, sure. DeFi stands for decentralized finance. Essentially, in blockchain, it's about building financial primitives on blockchain architecture to allow for decentralized forms of, let's say, trading, like a decentralized exchange, a decentralized way to execute a loan transaction, a decentralized way to, you know, collateralize your assets and lend against them, trade against them, you know, whatever else, right? So every single financial primitive you can think about that exists on Wall Street, how can you create it on this kind of immutable, self-executing architecture of public blockchains to allow for efficiency and essentially, you know, not requiring any middlemen to actually execute these transactions? So, you know, the amount of organic uptake and real usage, still in the early days, right? But I think it's pretty fundamental in the sense that Bitcoin is a standalone asset that serves a use case, but it doesn't mean that there's going to be a huge blockchain economy, right? All the different other dApps we thought were going to exist, like people building the next Facebook on blockchain, the people building the next whatever game, Fortnite on blockchain, right? They haven't materialized. But the numbers are there and the data is there that the amount of people interacting with like a Uniswap where you can trade one asset for the other in a decentralized way, where you could lend and collateralize your assets in a decentralized way. You know, the numbers are there. There's tons of people participating in these protocols. There's tons of assets in the hundreds of billions locked up in these protocols. And right now, I think, yes, it's still in some ways an early experiment, like all deep tech is, right? Because at the end of the day, there's still regulatory hurdles. There's still other adoption hurdles, right? It's still hard to onboard as a, let's say, non-crypto native onto some of these protocols, how to deal with your key management, how to deal with like doing your transactions, gas fees. Like, yes, we get it. The problems are crazy. But I also think that, you know, if it's one of the, that's one of the things I love about venture is, yes, you have to look at how things go wrong, but you, more importantly, you have to be an optimist and look at how big things are if they go right. If DeFi goes right, I think that it should be the de facto architecture for the Wall Street and for the financial transactions of the future, right? And that is a huge amount of value that could be unlocked. So we look for these asymmetric kind of bets. You know, in India, there are also some good, great, you know, even looking at Matic, like how great like Matic has done in this cycle, right? Like,
I was just about crazy. To bring that up.
Yeah, crazy. I mean, they're not exactly DeFi, but still like obviously in the ecosystem as a L2 solution. And yeah, so I think that clearly world-class can be built out of India, fundamentally global from day one. There's no kind of geography-specific blockchain application that I've ever heard of, except for maybe some of the Chinese apps just by usage. So yeah, that's an area I'm definitely very excited in. Yeah, other areas, I mean, I know that like a lot of folks have been talking about it, but I personally am definitely quite passionate about female health. I think that in general health, chronic illness, et cetera, large TAM in India, you know, nobody serving the women. Somebody was even telling me today that like, you know, 40, 50% of people on CureFit are women, you know, but they don't necessarily are able to leverage that for some specific needs, for maybe health, et cetera. So I think there are a lot of interesting opportunities out there in that space. And it's great to see some, you know, female founders building that out, whether that's for PCOS, fertility, menopause, less represented, but definitely seen some pretty cool projects coming out of there. Yeah, so just two off the top of my mind.
That's awesome. I mean, I think you just hit the nail on the head with the crypto, at least, because I know, you know, there's something on this cycle that I've noticed is it's not just layer one protocols that are being adopted, but also layer two protocols that are starting to come up. You see ADA, Matic, all these kind of protocols being adopted. And then I think it was yesterday or day before, Solana got a huge investment. They did a private token sale with Andreessen Horowitz, which of course is a good signal for Solana, I think. They aim to be the next Ethereum or a better version of Ethereum. So I know you worked at Dunya Labs. What was your work there? Was it related to some of these protocols? What exactly did that, how did that happen? How did that come about? And do you still sort of stay in touch with what you were working at there?
Yeah, so I mean, me and Srikar started Dunya just like wanting to build something in crypto, wanting to build products. We had been paying attention to the space for years, like more just like investing, looking at projects, you know, some engaging in services, et cetera. And yeah, we really wanted to start building products for this space. We thought 2018 was a great time to get started. And we were basically building dev tools for different dApp developers on Ethereum competitor chains. So back then, like in 2018, Like it's so crazy because crypto chain is like lightning, right? But back then, the two protocols that we were really thought were promising, one was like some of these DPoS chains like EOS and, you know, et cetera. And the second was like Definity and some of these newer folks. And we were like, let's build a bunch of tools so that, you know, dApp developers can more easily deploy dApps on these new age Ethereum chains, like Ethereum competitor chains, sorry. And yeah, so we did that. I think that timing, yeah, not great. Probably also didn't pick the right protocols. Also in general, I think back then, like if you even look at, you know, if you even look at like Cosmos or if you even look at Definity, it had finally launched like this year. So, you know what I mean? Like things were still taking that like year to year kind of time to really see that maturation. Solana didn't exist. Matic had just launched and wasn't sure what it's, you know, wasn't super sure about the tech. And yeah, so that's what we were doing. I think that for me in crypto, I mean, look, one of the things I tell people all the time is I think if you want to be a crypto entrepreneur, like this whole caveat speech I gave about, you know, people should actually know what it means to be like a VC backed entrepreneur. Oh my God, that caveat is like 100x for a crypto entrepreneur. You know, just it's a totally different ball game. Like even starting any VC backed business versus starting a crypto business, it's totally like so different in terms of the ecosystem, your daily routine, right? Just think about it. It's first of all, it's a 24/7 job by default, right? Like nobody can pick, oh, I'm just going to do US customers. No, from day one, like you're literally going to have 10,000 people in your Telegram pinging you at every single hour, minute of the day. You know, your business is tied to an asset that's going to fluctuate in price and most of the time out of your control, right? Like literally the rules of the game are just different. And I think that A, I was very young, and B, we had just strategically probably definitely picked the wrong direction to go in, like even building, you know, dev tools. And instead of just doing maybe like something in DeFi early back then, people are already starting like some of these early lending protocols and et cetera. So yeah, definitely strategic errors on our part. And secondly, I think just at least me, I mean, my co-founder, I'm not sure. I think today, you know, he's still working in stuff crypto. So I think that he definitely loves it. I love it as a field, but I think that, you know, the active requirements of running a business in crypto, maybe not for me. So yeah. So nowadays I'm really happy supporting entrepreneurs in this space, investing in this space. 98% of my net worth is in crypto. So I'm a big believer, but yeah, just probably I'm not the right founder for the space.
So do you still think that DeFi is a way to go for someone who might be starting a new company in the space, or is there like something beyond DeFi that might be popping up now?
I mean, I think the biggest prize in the space is like, is if you become the de facto layer one, right? So it's one of the reasons why I've like become a little bit of a, I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist, but I'm just like, yeah, Ethereum, obviously, like there's no Bitcoin competitor, right? But there's like 10, not necessarily Ethereum competitors, but functioning different value additions for value propositions to an Ethereum, right? And honestly, it's just going to take the next 5 years, maybe even 10 years to figure out which chain wins. We're still super early. Different chains, different propositions, you know, maybe it's a multi-chain world, maybe it's a whatever, you know, Atom, Polkadot kind of like world, who knows. But I think that's a huge prize, right? If you become the de facto, or at least your protocol is able to lock up a lot of the valuable economic activity that happens, you know, on the DeFi of the future, that's massive. And people have been working on these projects for, you know, years with crazy teams behind them. But I think that that is the biggest prize in the ecosystem for sure. Beyond that, on the application side, yeah, DeFi, I mean, I'm also really positive about just general, what do I call it, general user experience in crypto. I think if you look at things like just key management, you know, how to use some of these protocols, how to manage gas, how to manage, it's not intuitive, right? So who's going to create that? No, I don't think that necessarily every, you know, like millennial in the US is going to go and be able to execute, you know, download MetaMask, execute a Uniswap transaction, like, you know, honestly, or deal with impermanent loss when you're farming. Like it's pretty esoteric. So how do we create those on-ramps, and how do we create those experience layers. And honestly, even since 2018, I've been saying this over and over again in a billion places, like Chinese teams are doing way better on this, I think, than the West. Like the amount of kind of wallets, abstractions, decentralized wallets, like different ways to create that onboarding experience, way more activity there than what I've necessarily seen in the West. But yeah, that's another big part. I think there's so many opportunities though, because this, even DeFi itself, like we are at the most primitive level of what it could mean, right? So I think there's a lot to be done.
Definitely.
What do you make of this? I don't know, for example, the Chinese government recently took some steps against Bitcoin mining, for example. And but you just said that, you know, Chinese teams are doing a lot better than the West in terms of building these abstractions, these on-ramps. So where do you see this intersection of power versus innovation and how they're going to interact? Do you think that there might be some issues in the near future?
Yeah, well, I have to say one thing, which is that the balance between power and innovation is way better handled in China than it is in India. if you look at India's stance towards crypto, it's been even more confusing and less enabling. And honestly, like 1% or 0.1% of the value that's already been created in the Chinese ecosystem. So anyways, that's a whole other rant for another day. But I think in China, I mean, the key thing to the Chinese, let's say powers that be, which is the political, Politburo there, is stability. And obviously crypto has lots of things that do not bring stability, not least the crazy volatility in the markets. They've kind of, like, if you think about it, mining in China has been around, like Chinese miners are some of the earliest miners. So we're talking 2010, 2009 miners, right? And if you have 30% of the hash power in China, clearly the government's not stupid. They didn't wake up one day and say, oh, crap, we have all this mining. Like they literally had an eye on this thing and they've let it mature to this state, right? Where it's a huge amount of economic activity in Bitcoin mining in China. Now, I think there's a lot of things internally in China that are happening. If you even look at just people have been talking about the Chinese corporate debt for ages, you know, even if you look at what's happened with Ali and financial, right, IPO, like clearly systemic risk in the financial ecosystem has become, if you look at what happened like 2 years ago in P2P in China, like there's huge focus now from the regulators on just stability and specifically systemic financial stability. So obviously they were like, okay, this thing is getting out of hand. Like we need to get rid of this too. So I think actually long-term it's good because if there is a powerful government in the world who can create some kind of coordinated, God knows what, whatever Bitcoin, like it's probably China. So, you know, I think that having it be more decentralized, having some of this infrastructure move out of China, long-term bullish. Short term, I still think China is also a country where it's really good at being like, okay, on one hand, we need to have control, but on the other hand, we cannot lose the innovation race, right? You see this in AI, you see this in blockchain. Like look at what's happening with digital RMB. I mean, China moved on that in 2 years from literally thinking about it, conceiving, working with like MakerDAO, you know, kind of like devs and seeing what the crypto kind of, you know, specs have been, to like literally in China today, you know, 20 million people can like spend digital Federal Reserve currency on central bank currency, sorry, not Federal Reserve, central bank currency on their phones. So I think that they're in blockchain in a big way and they're going to continue trying to allow for innovation. They just don't want the kind of innovation that's going to create, you know, crazy instability, which is probably why like trading and all this activity doesn't mean you can't do a crypto company in China. You still can, for sure. You can still build applications that are highly relevant, like I said, on the application side, on the onboarding side, you whatever it is. But yeah, you have to be careful not to ruffle their feathers on the whole creating systemic risk thing.
Definitely. And, you know, I keep telling some of my friends that I'll truly believe that crypto is getting really big when I see one of my Indian friends own an NFT, maybe a CryptoPunk or a Bored Ape.
I know. The time is already here, right? $69 million Beeple was bought by an Indian. Like, the time has come.
I don't know them personally. So I guess I need to make friends with them.
Oh, you need to know them personally. Got it.
Yeah. Just maybe in a couple of degrees of sphere of influence. But I know friends here who own NFTs. And I think at that point, you start to wonder, oh, like, this is real. There's real people who really value art. And, you know, that's great. And I think things like these will only grow with once you create more abstractions, which is something you mentioned earlier. For example, you know, there's a lot of tools and development in China, like wallets, OpenSea, Rarible. I don't know if people in India know that yet. I've asked some of my friends, they don't. But I think people are catching on pretty fast. So that's something to look out for. So I think, you know, you mentioned that crypto regulation, or at least crypto direction from the government, is kind of ambiguous in India. So what do you suggest they do to maybe rectify that? And on related lines, like, how can India benefit from crypto?
Yeah. Okay. I think that, you know, Nitin, by the way, my partner, has his organization, previous organization that he started, Encrypt, has written an amazing long report about this in conjunction, I think, or presented to Niti Aayog. So you guys should definitely check that out. Encrypt, Encrypt. Him and Sumuk wrote this entire thing, and they lay out the case pretty well. But I think that there's so many different ways India can benefit. I mean, the first thing is just, again, if DeFi, if blockchain becomes the underlying infrastructure for whether it's the financial world or the internet at large, like, imagine if India today does not partake in that, or does not allow for people to build businesses, experiment, create assets, and, you know, get exposure to this, right? Like, you're out the game. You're done. And I don't think that, you know, India hasn't really contributed either to the other, like, main, let's say, infra or operating systems of the world, you know, but, like, are you really going to restrict a burgeoning tech ecosystem from participating in this one? I think is a big question. Second, is just, you know, innovation within its, for use cases that are specific to India that I think are possible, whether it's with digital central bank currencies, or in the future, even, you know, different kinds of blockchain enabled applications, right? So it's kind of like, I think that blockchain gets such a bad rep because it does have this asset side to it. It is linked to, you know, assets, and governments don't like assets being out of their control, decentralized. These words are really scary for them. I just read something about how even the CFTC guy, like, probably read up on some more defined granular definitions of DeFi, and he was like, oh my God, actually, I'm not about this. So I get it from a regulator's perspective why some of this is worrisome, but I think what's great about, you know, places like Singapore, Japan, even the US to a large extent, China, is the view is like, okay, technology is here to stay, right? Like, banning, I think the governments need to realize now that people, talent, technologies, like, are way more mobile than the jurisdiction of the nation state. If you are not going to create an innovation friendly place, if you are not going to create guardrails to allow for safe innovation and very clear guidelines on what regulated innovation is, you're either going to have people partake in unregulated, below ground, underground innovation, which is always suboptimal. And probably you can't, you know, tax them or see the benefits of that, or they're going to leave the country, right? The town will leave the country. So I think that that's kind of what at stake here. What we need is, we need clarity. We don't want something like this whole ban, unban, right? That doesn't help. Like, think about, I think all the time, crypto entrepreneurs in India are so, have so much perseverance, right? Because literally they keep getting the systemic shock. Okay, it's banned. Okay, no, it's not banned. Okay, it's banned now. And I mean, that, imagine, like, getting the rug pulled under you, like, multiple times, right? As an entrepreneur, critical to your business, like, that's so demoralizing. The second is so we need something clear and for it to not change. The second is obviously way more pro of a regulate above ground and be clear about those regulations versus blanket ban, right? For all the reasons I outlined before. And if we can get just to a clear framework, which, again, there are global parallels to this. It's not, there's so many countries, and, you know, whether it's Switzerland, Crypto Zoo, Crypto Valley, right? Whether it's Singapore, whether it's, so many places have created those early roadmaps to what that guardrailed innovation looks like. So, you know, we don't have to start from scratch or anything.
Cool. Yeah, that was a pretty dense discussion, actually. And I think I learned quite a few things there, heard a few terms I hadn't really heard before. So I'm definitely going to listen to this recording again and read up on some stuff. So switching gears a little bit and talking more about your writing. So I've noticed that you're a prolific writer, and one of your blog posts is titled First Principles. So could you tell us a little bit about what those principles are and how they've influenced your work?
Yeah. Thanks, by the way, for reading all that. I mean, it's like I put it on my Twitter and on my LinkedIn and stuff, but it's not topical, you know, information at all. People think they're going to read some tech startup stuff. I'm like, okay, here's some pretty literary writing about my life. So thanks for checking it out. I'm always surprised. So these are kinds of, I'm kind of like, I'm definitely a big believer in, you know, strong beliefs loosely held. I'm also a big believer in sticking to certain iterations of goals or principles for at least a certain amount of time. These aren't things I want to change that often. I think that, I was really blessed to have like a lot of exposure in my early life, had an amazing education, got to travel the world, got to also deal with some very real struggles, right? Like, I think I write this in my other posts as well, but you know, I've been through highs, rock bottom, everything. And so by the time I was like coming out of college and I was like 22, 23, I was like, honestly, I think I studied philosophy as well. I was like, I really think that like 80, 70%, or at least like I have a pretty solid view of at least for the next 5 years, what's really important to me in my life. Some of those first principles is, I think firstly, it was strive for excellence, which I think I try in everything I do. Secondly, is to live values first. I think that one thing is that there's a tension between these two, right? Because on one hand, we're always trying to strive for excellence, do bigger, do better, get a better job, get a better impact, you know, have a bigger kind of like a personal footprint on the world. But I think that, you know, I always take that step back and I'm like, okay, what? And I ask myself this at least once a year and I write it down, which is like, what is the worst? You know, what is the worst that can happen? And can I live with that? And most of the time I come back to, you know, if I have my freedom, which in and of itself is difficult, right? So many people, 80% of the people living around the world do not have that freedom of expression, freedom of financial freedom to at least be able to provide for your basics, right? Or the life standard you're happy with without having to take up, you know, work that just sucks. You know, all freedom is actually incredibly hard to achieve. And I think most people have to work their entire lives just to try to get that, which is a sad state of the world today. But, you know, freedom and dignity, if those things I can have, you know, I think I'm everything else is just upside, right? Or as some of my friends say, you know, entertainment. Those two are really the main things that you want to achieve. Thirdly is to be disciplined, because I think I grew up at that weird, like I was born in 96. So I'm literally like that last year of millennial kind of first year Gen Z weird freak kind of like place in history, you know, where on one hand, I wasn't like completely inundated with technology when I was 10, but it definitely happened in my life pretty early where there was just like a lot. And it has a marked impact on your brain, right? I think that, you know, the way that we engage with stimulus today, and that's why I love meditation, I love yoga, because control over your mind is basically a scarce kind of thing these days. And, you know, I always try to remember that. Be frugal is my fourth one. I think this one's really important because as, you know, I see so many times unhappiness where people continue to achieve and hit on that strive for excellence thing, but their lifestyle also really changes alongside that as well. The whole keeping up with the Joneses, you know, now I need this, now I need that. And then you're 40 and you're like, wait, I didn't actually need any of this shit. Oh my God, I hate my life. And so I always remind myself that, yeah, these literally capitalism is designed to make us forget about the cost of these things and to inflate the value of them at face value, right? So I try to be frugal. Fifth, I try to be bold and take risks. This is something because my parents never did that because, again, they didn't have that freedom, right? Just the fact that they emigrated to America and gave me a fantastic education, I never have to worry about making a living. And that is freedom, right? So I think that if I don't take risks, you know, that's really sad. And take action on my empathy. That's, you know, one reason I love living in India too, is that you can never stray too far away from that. There's so many ways that you can give back, right? And you can't live, I mean, people in India still do, and I'm shocked, like live in a little bubble where they're literally like, none of this is happening. And I'm just like, how? If you look out the street, I mean, isn't there so many things you'd like to do for like others? So, and the last one, embrace impermanence, which I think you also kind of spoke about, or you know, you asked in that list you sent me, but this is a big one, which I think, yeah, sometimes I think this is like embracing impermanence is the mental model I use for dealing with more broadly my life. Probably the first, like I even have this tattooed on my hand, a Nietzsche, which means impermanence, by the way, as a daily reminder, because there's so much we can get caught up in. But if you can take that, it's all about being in the moment, like when I'm in the moment, when I'm zoned in, it's all about striving for excellence, winning, right? Getting to the next step, doing it bigger, doing it better. But I need that ability to step out and be like, okay, yeah, like literally nothing matters, right? I mean, my life is impermanent. Nobody's going to remember me. AGI is going to take over. Like, and I should just be happy and try to be a good person and not put too much emphasis. Like the energy is the emphasis and the love and effort you put and the discipline you put into your work. But once you get too attached to any kind of input or output, you know, you're just setting yourself up for unhappiness. That's how I feel. So I just try to take that step back, maybe too often.
I don't think you can do it too often. AGI will take over. So I'm optimistic. I guess on a related note, though, you mentioned that life feeds you promises of immortality. I think that's something you wrote. And I was very curious to see what are those, what do you consider as immortality? What to you is that promise of immortality that life keeps giving on to you? Or
when I mean, one simple thing is like, you know, how much we fetishize like billionaires or billionaire founders, right? How many Twitter threads do I read that's like 10 things I learned from a billionaire, 10 things I learned from a unicorn founder, this is a unicorn founder, this is blah. And I'm just like, I mean, look, people who have created massive value, so much respect, you know, but do I want every young person from the age of 16 to be reading this content and modeling their life off of that? Because it is a little bit chasing immortality, you know, that life, like even something, I think Paul Graham said something today, which is like, you know, yeah, if you want to change the world, you're gonna have to work a lot. If you don't want to, you don't have to work a lot, and it's totally fine. And that's exactly my stance, which is like, everyone needs to go out and instead of being, you know, I think impacted by what they're reading and what people are assigning status and attention, which is usually folks that have, you know, in some ways achieved immortality seemingly, right, by just the impact they have, the wealth they've amassed, the name that they have, it's everywhere, everyone knows that person, right? That's immortality and legacy, at least in a human sense. But if every young person is constantly reading that and then, you know, not going through that deeper level of like, what are my preferences? Like prima facie, you know, what are my preferences like without any noise? Like, let me go live in a mountain. Like, what do I want? What are my preferences? Who am I? Before you figure that out, I think, and I was like that too. I was very much just like, okay, these are what it seems like, mimetic desires, right? It's how human beings work. It seems like everyone wants this thing, so I want it. And then you're like, okay, wait, like, no, I don't want that. And I think early in life, I was really lucky because I met a bunch of people who influenced me a lot, who, you know, kind of were just had gone through that life path where they're like, you know, the consequences of not figuring out your own preferences really deeply is like literally so much unhappiness that you can't unravel, time that you can't get back. So I was trying to be more like, okay, let me figure out that stuff first, you know, before I'm very impressionable. I'm like, let me figure that out first before I get caught up in the wrong thing.
Quick question on the going and living in the mountains point. So like, I've also been really wanting to learn how to meditate or like establish a meditation habit. So how did you go about doing that? And because for me, like I know everyone's talked about how meditation is really good for you, and a lot of people know the benefits, but just, I don't know, how do you like stay on top of it?
Yeah, totally. Good question. I'm actually going to pull up, like, I have something here, which is like a meditation manual or something that I had written for a friend.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think everyone can use that.
I had a couple principles. One was, I was like, incremental progression. Yeah, which I agree with. So I didn't do this, actually. The way I started meditation was as research for the book, because Vipassana was such a big part of my co-author's life. I went and did Vipassana being like, oh yeah, cool, like let me try it. And then literally on day four, I was just like, oh my God, I'm flipping out. This is not good. I'm freaking out. And it was a really challenging experience. And I don't expect everyone to go through that. But you know, one of the good things about that was after 10 days, I got through the 10 days, I don't know how, was I came out. And because that 10 days is so intense, right? You're suddenly, it's not incremental at all. You're like, okay, 10 days now, you meditate on average 8 to 10 hours a day, right? That's like 80 hours of meditation. You come out, and one thing that was true for me was that the effects were indisputable. You know, some people are like, okay, maybe it's making me feel a little better. I came out of 80 hours of meditation and I was like, oh my God, you know, just the clarity in my brain, the calm that I feel, the ability to like just be in control with my decision-making, you know, it was so obvious. And it was so obvious to the people around me as well. you know, who were just like, oh my goodness, you know, you seem like a different person. I kept getting that. And I got cocky about it. You know, I was like, yeah, I'm a different person, Kathy, like V2, you know, Kathy post-meditation. And then 2 months later, after not practicing it at all, my boyfriend at the time were like, yeah, you're the same again. And I was like, oh my God, no. So I went back to the incremental progression part, which was, you know, just starting 5 minutes a day, adding 5 minutes every time the original time feels, you know, becomes relatively easy. Consistency, I think, is super key. Thirdly, I think just keep it simple. You know, you don't have to do anything. The whole idea, you don't need to pay for a calm for $150. You don't need to listen to some guided thing. You don't need to do transcendental and pay $1,000 and go to a retreat. Like, you just literally sit down. You just sit down and do nothing and focus on your breath. Like, it's super simple. Anyone can do it for $0, zero props, zero apps, anything.
Hardest thing in the world.
Yeah, it's actually incredibly hard, but it's an easy process, right? And again, I think that it's just like exercise or any of these incremental kind of lifestyle changes. Like, you have to do it consistently until, or you just go to Vipassana like I did, and then you just have this where you're like, okay, I cannot dispute the effects of this. And once you have that aha moment, I think it's really hard to stop it, because you're just like, it is like a superpower. You know, you're like, why would I give this up if I know that that's how I can be, you know, with this practice in my life? Like, that's the kind of clarity, calm, emotional regulation, self-control, discipline I can add to my life just by doing something so easy, free, and, you know, takes just some time in my day.
Definitely. I think, you know, my mom also keeps talking about, so she started doing some meditation as well. And she keeps always mentioning how great it has been for her and how transformative it has been for her. So I think just following that process, like you mentioned, it's a simple process, but it's harder to stay disciplined. And the beginning's always the toughest, right? It's always
the beginning's the toughest.
Exactly.
Totally.
Just starting out.
Yeah, and one of the things I see to people all the time is that they're like, oh, but I meditated, but I felt distracted. And I think that's one of my principles I have in my manual as well, is like, feeling distracted doesn't mean it's not working. Like, in fact, clearing your mind is not how meditation becomes effective. Being aware enough to, so what actually changes your brain, like literally the gray matter in your brain when you're meditating, is if you notice that you're distracted, if that awareness of being distracted, and then you undistract yourself, you know, you focus on your breath again. So that constant like awareness of when you're distracted, how to fix that. Okay, maybe you get distracted again. Okay, just fix that again. Be aware of it. That is actually what rewires our prefrontal cortex. So if you are distracted, you might actually be even having a more productive meditation session than someone who's just like, I'm totally calm / maybe even asleep, you know? So the delta of that's really high. So I don't know why people are afraid of being distracted. I'm like, yeah, being distracted is good, because that's when you're exercising the muscle, like when you're actually aware and correcting that distraction.
Exactly. I mean, that makes complete sense. So I think I'll definitely try to meditate. I think that's on my list.
That manual will be great, honestly.
I'll send it to you guys. You guys deserve it.
Thank you. We're honored. And, you know, and to end off the podcast, this is a question we like to ask all of our guests. I think it gives us a lot of insight and the listeners a lot of insight into maybe what your biggest ambitions or dreams are. If money wasn't a problem, would you go about solving a problem in the world? And if so, what would that problem be?
Yeah, that's a great question. If there's one problem I would solve if money was not an issue, I mean, it's overstated, but I genuinely think that probably either longevity or climate change. I think longevity, because, you know, at the end of the day, the reason why we have to make so many of these crazy decisions, the reason why I have to sit here and be like, okay, what are my first principles? What? Because if I mess up, like, I am going to be dead in 80 years, you know, I don't have a rerun of this. And if between 20 and 60, I'm confused and I go after the wrong things, it's like game over, right? But if there was no game over, or there was this longer, you know, more resources on the most scarce resource we have, then there's just so much more optionality. There's so much more chances for achieving that freedom, achieving that, you know, personal preference map, achieving those things within that map, because time is the most scarce thing. So that doesn't really mean longevity right now. It just means, you know, figuring out how the way our genes and bodies work to try to fight against and maybe one day eliminate disease. I do agree that there are also scary potential other risks to that world, right? Again, my impermanence philosophy is that, like, literally life and language have meaning because of constraints, not because of anything else. So yeah, what happens to meaning when there are no constraints, when things are literally maybe permanent, like your life. So anyways, those are big philosophical questions, but have you guys seen like The Good Life? It's like a Netflix show.
Yeah, I've seen it.
But maybe it'll be like that at the end where people just choose to die, which probably makes sense.
Yeah. Well, here's to hoping longevity succeeds, and I don't know, there's some cryogenic preservation as well. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was amazing.
Yeah, thanks guys for having me.